Watch your DVR Nevada Newsmakers Saturday and Sunday mornings from 5:30 to 6:30 on Cox Cable Channel 12 or Dish and Direct TV Channel 21 or anytime at NevadaNewsmakers.com.
And I have heard the same thing you've heard, that people are talking behind the scenes to each other to basically say, look, if we all run, it's going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight. We're going to spend a lot of money against each other.
From the Las Vegas Review-Journal, this is RJ Politics. Hello and welcome to RJ Politics, the Las Vegas Review-Journal's weekly political podcast. I'm politics reporter Rory Appleton.
And I'm politics and government editor Steve Sebelius.
We have a few different topics to get to this week. The first one is we're going to have a story in the Review-Journal this weekend about two of the largest races, the two really marquee races in this state in 2022. And I am fully aware that it is only barely April of 2021, but these things don't have an off season anymore. And then there's already some significant movement in both races. So we'll have a story. It should be online as this podcast is released, and it should be in the paper on Sunday. But it's essentially about the governor's race and the Senate race. You know, Senator Catherine Cortez Masto and Governor Steve Sisolak are both up for reelection. Two very important races, two races of national interest that will be targeted nationally. And, in doing some research and talking to quite a lot of folks on the ground here in Nevada and also some national sources and things like that, one is a lot more interesting than the other at this particular point. And that's the governor's race. So we've basically heard now that there are three sort of main kind of candidates who are definitely actively exploring a run for governor. And those are Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo, former Lieutenant Governor Mark Hutchison, and current Congressman Mark Amaday. I did speak to Mark Amaday. He was very candid about his interest, about having conversations with Lombardo and others about running and who's going to run and all that. And this would be, that would be a pretty crowded Republican primary. So the idea is that they're going to sort it out themselves. I mean, Steve, is that something that you've heard around as well, that it's those three are three of the ones who are seriously considering?
Yeah, absolutely. I have heard those three names more than any other names. Dean Heller's name was also in there, but I'm thinking that he may not be involved in this race. He may not want to do it. He did want to do it before. I don't think he was ever happy in D.C. as a senator. And I think he contemplated, coming back and running for governor. Adam Laxalt scared him and a number of other people, including some people on our list here, out of the race for governor last time in 2018. And so I don't know that Heller is going to do it. But, the strategy is smart. And I have heard the same thing you've heard, that people are talking behind the scenes to each other to basically say, look, if we all run, it's going to be a knockdown, drag out fight. We're going to spend a lot of money against each other. We're going to end up, penniless at the end of the Republican primary and come out. And then Governor Sisolak is just sitting there fat and happy. No opponent on the Democratic side, raising money left and right once the session ends. So it doesn't make sense. So let's settle on a single candidate. And that actually is a very smart idea, I think, on the Republican side. I think it's smart for them to do that. I don't know if there are any wild card candidates. There almost always are. Interesting to me about these things, and Lombardo is sort of a question mark because, as sheriff, he has not had a partisan job, and he really hasn't engaged in any partisan rhetoric. So we don't know 100% where he stands. But both Hutch, by Hutch, I refer to, of course, former Lieutenant Governor Mark Hutchison, whose nickname is Hutch, and Mark Amaday, neither of them are known as being a Trump person. In fact, I think Hutch would most closely identify himself as a Brian Sandoval Republican, and that's certainly not Donald Trump territory. And Mark Amaday was kicked off the Trump reelection campaign for the grievous sin of basically saying, look, with this Ukraine business, I want to find out if any laws were broken. I'm not saying I'm going to impeach the guy. And he ultimately, he didn't vote to impeach the guy. He just said, I want to find out what's going on. What, you know, if there were any laws broken, let's hear about it, which is a very reasonable kind of thing, especially for somebody who by training is a lawyer, which Amadei is. And for that, he was tossed out. So neither of these guys are in the Trump camp. And to me, the Trump issue still looms large. And I think some of these candidates understand that in their own minds, that, you know, the Trump base is still a very significant part of the Republican Party. And they're going to have to get that base. And that's got to be part of what they're discussing. Who can motivate that Donald Trump base? Because, you know, it's really true. If you ran a moderate, and I think Mark Hutchison on many issues is a moderate, what would the Trump base do? Would they turn out, or would they just not show up? And I think the very real possibility is a lot of them would just not show up, because they'd say, look, the guy is a rhino. He's not a fire breathing, you know, insult tweeting guy who is going to really take it to the other side. In fact, he's known, when he ran for state senate, he was known for running the, you know, nicest, most clean and mud-free campaign I think the state has ever seen. So he's sort of the anti-Trump in that sense. And do they stay home? And what implications does that have for Sisolak's reelection? And so I think those are questions that really they all are thinking about and debating amongst themselves.
Absolutely. And I think the debate is really about two very different races. One is a primary, where you see candidates traditionally sort of run to the polls. You know, you've got to get those red-blooded conservatives, you know, and many of those fire-breathing Trump supporters, as you mentioned, to back you to get out of a primary. And you have to spend some money, enough money, but not so much money that you're totally crippled once you are able to get out of it. You don't want to limp out of a primary. And I think that's a very interesting dynamic in this governor's race, because you have folks who are seen as pretty moderate all the way down. Amadei is quoted throughout the story. And he basically, you know, he doesn't pull a whole lot of punches in saying that he really doesn't like how the Republicans have conducted this last election, certainly, and even before that. He basically told me the exact quote was that you're not going to bash your way to the governor's office. We saw enough of that last time. You need to find issues and connect with voters in that way. You need to appeal to nonpartisans. And, you know, whoever the Republican is needs to find a way to not lose Clark County by 100,000 votes or some, you know, egregious number by that. They've got to cut that margin. You're not going to win it, but you got to cut that margin. You have to hold on to Washoe County. Amadei is basically saying, I've done that. Some other candidates, you know, haven't in the past. You know, he's happy to talk shop. There's a lot of that in the piece if you want to really dig into all of that. But it the primary question is an interesting one, because there are other moderates. I spoke to State Senator Heidi Gansert and State Senator Ben Kiekhefer, who are both interested in either governor's race or the Senate race, rumored, I should say. Heidi Gansert is basically saying she's focused on her legislative career. She just got reelected there. That's what she's saying. Kiekhefer is termed out, and he's more actively considering the positions. But those candidates, you know, the general consensus is that they might struggle to get out of a primary. They might do well in a general where you would like a moderate, and there's nonpartisan voters, and there's unaffiliated, you know, third party voters, and folks who are not, you know, so partisan in their affiliation to where they really tip the scales. And it's a very close race in which both candidates on Democrats and Republicans are going to run a general race. In the middle, they're going to be, you know, trying not to, you know, pull to party extremes. And so it's interesting to see, you know, who's going to be able to make it out of the primary in that race, who could also win a general. And I think that's the conversations that are happening between those three. There are some other candidates a little bit further down. I did speak to North Las Vegas Mayor John J. Lee, who has for years been rumored of switching parties. From the Democratic Party, he's currently Democrat, to the Republican Party. and that he would, you know, there's rumor, there's speculation that he'd be willing to challenge Sisolak. Those two apparently have some old beef as well, and he when I spoke to him, he basically said that he gave me the, you know, what is, and I don't mean this in a negative way, what is the typical answer this early on in an off year, which is, I have been approached by different people in both parties to consider doing this. I am flattered, and at this point, there are some big projects in North Las Vegas that I am focused on. That's about as standard an answer as you're going to get to, yeah, I'm thinking about it, but I'm not publicly thinking about it, not yet. So, you know, it's going to be something to race. I think there's also a good chance that you could see, you know, folks from the business world or anything like that who jump into this race specifically, who maybe have opposed, you know, the governor's shutdown rules or you know, all the many, you know, restrictions that were in place to keep people, you know, from getting sick, to keep, you know, try and curtail spread of the virus, you know, in this last year. I could totally see that happening. But yeah, you mentioned Dean Heller, and I had also heard in my reporting that he may want to get in back into some sort of state office, but he's also fine, you know, sort of staying home on the ranch as well.
Yeah, exactly. And the funny thing is, I mean, the names that we're talking about here, Gansert, Key Keffer, Amade, Hutch, all of those candidates are great general election candidates, because I think they are a more moderate Republican. They don't turn off independents. They don't turn off Democrats. And I think they could probably get some of the other side. I mean, I think they could get crossover votes. And you know, each one has something. You know, Mark Hutchison was the lawyer for those infamous 2007-2018 recalls. That's kind of a black mark with him. Amade has a congressional record. And of course, you know, there's tons of stuff that you can deploy against Amade. You know, you could say he talked a good game, but voted with Trump, voted not to impeach Trump a couple of times and all of that. Ben Key Keffer, I think it would be a great Republican statewide candidate. He would have to spend a lot of money to improve his name recognition in other parts of the state. Same with Heidi Gansert. They're all the problem with all for all those people is not the general. It is the primary. It's getting over that big mountain. Climbing the Everest that is the Republican primary. After that, it's I'm not going to say it's all downhill, because Sisolak is going to be a fairly formidable candidate, I think, in his own right. He's going to raise money. He's going to have things that he did that I think you can, you know, point to. He can point to that justify his reelection. And so, but they would be good. They would be good candidates. They would be good candidates. The problem for Republicans is what happens if they nominate, and I don't see on this list, we'll talk about Senate in a second, but the name Adam Laxalt or a similar name does not appear on this list. And if there was an Adam Laxalt, that person would be the favorite to win the primary. Let's just be honest about it. Adam Laxalt won the primary by default. Nobody even decided to run against him because everybody in Nevada knew that he was going to appeal to that party base. Now, I think his image has been shattered a little bit. I think he's been shown a little bit to be a paper tiger after his performance against Sisolak, which was abysmal. It was one of the worst campaigns I think I've ever seen, and certainly the worst campaign for governor in the state of Nevada that I've seen since I've been covering it. And that's been going back a number of years. So someone like that, if there was a person who could excite the Trump base who was a better candidate, and I don't know who this person might be, that person, I think, would win a primary. And so all of these folks talking amongst themselves is good. They've got to watch out for that X factor, though, and what who that X factor might be going forward. And I think that could really be a problem in the primary. But the general is a completely different animal. And I think, you know, we've seen it before in 2010. Jim Gibbons was running for a second term, and Rory Reed, the son of the senator, was the Clark County Commission chairman, and he was running for governor against against Gibbons. And some wise Republicans in the state of Nevada realized, look, we're going to lose. We will lose with Jim Gibbons. He's too far to the right. He has been a not a good governor. He's sort of been a clown in terms of, you know, going down to Office Depot and buying a veto stamp and holding a thing. And, you know, he actually stamped veto on bills and held them up for reporters to see. That veto stamp, by the way, is in the state museum now. You know, they realized he was going to lose. So what they did was they went and they found a moderate Republican in Brian Sandoval, who in many ways is the perfect Nevada candidate. Not too far to the left, not too far to the right, reasonable, good-looking, articulate guy. And he turned out to be one of the best governors that Nevada has seen, Republican or Democrat, in recent memory. And so I think that, you know, Republicans would be wise to look at that Sandoval example and say, was that Sandoval wasn't a unicorn. I mean, there are other people like him who could do it. The trouble that they have this time, though, is that there's no arch conservative governor to run against to be a counter class to. There's just Sisolak. And Sisolak, being a moderate Democrat, I think is going to be tougher to beat in that respect, because, you know, there's really it's going to be harder to run against that. And so I think it'll be very interesting to see if that, you know, more right wing candidate emerges, who that might be and how they might do a challenge to the group that we're discussing here. And there's other names that are out there that we have heard that are pending a decision. Who knows, you know, what could happen. Celebrity is always a factor, you know. And so I think it'll be fascinating to watch this governor's race unfold. One thing is certain, and that is that Steve Sisolak is not going to get a free ride, and he is going to have to answer for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. He's going to have to answer for that. I think, depending on how this blockchain story, you know, unfolds, he's going to have to answer for that as well, because this was not a legislative proposal. This was something that Sisolak put in his state of the state address. This is something he has been behind. And depending on how that all plays out, the even money is saying it's probably not going to happen. But, you know, to the extent that he really gets behind it and pushes it, that could be a factor in that reelection as well. And then, of course, we have the tax factor and what's going to happen with taxes. Can he emerge unscathed in this first term with the tax issue? So all of those things, I think, are playing into to this very exciting governor's race.
Sure, sure. And you know, I think Republicans were definitely wanting to run against Sisolak on a message of, you know, mishandling of the pandemic. But remember, I mean, the meat of the campaigning is going to be a year from now. And I really do think that both the governor and Senator Cortez Masto are going to be running on messages of recovery. You know, the economy. And Mark Amadei said that flat out. He told me, you know, in clear English that he also believes the economy by then will be on the upswing again. And you know, there'll be many, you know, sort of, you know, positive changes between now and 2022, that will be tough hurdles for any sort of Republican to run against. And the governor, you know, for his money is essentially saying, well, you know, I've got $4.5 million in the bank. It's been fundraising this whole time, you know, in these sort of off years and stuff. I am who I am. I've done what I've done on all this, and I welcome, you know, sort of any and all takers, you know, on that end. On the Senate side, it's less complicated and it's more complicated because you mentioned Laxalt, and the overwhelming consensus among Republicans and Democrats is that the Republican nomination for Senate, as you mentioned, the gubernatorial, you know, election, you know, when he lost the Sisolak in 2018. Is Laxalt to claim whenever he wishes it. essentially. Nobody's really heard much from him since the election. He has stopped doing, you know, he was doing multiple weekly sort of news conferences to talk about, you know, this mass fraud that was not actually, you know, apparently happening in the county and in the state, as has, you know, been borne out for months now. And he really has sort of disappeared. He continues to send out his regular newsletters through his PAC.
He had an op-ed in the Reno Gazette Journal this week.
And also in the Washington Examiner, I believe, as well. Yeah. I've seen he's been writing, but he hasn't been sort of out and in front of cameras in the way that he was last year, I would say.
That all dried up really quickly, didn't it?
It was immediate. Many Republicans in the state had similar disappearing acts, but have since reemerged. I called him for the story. I have not been able to get him on the phone for about 4 months or so, if I had to take a guess. But basically, in talking to national sources, I mean, it's clear that Adam Laxalt could basically walk into a Trump endorsement. He was a very loyal soldier, you know, during the election. He was Trump's voice in Nevada when the president himself was not here. I mean, he was doing all of the press conferences towards the end of the campaign. You know, it was this motley crew basically of Laxalt, of Rick Grenell, and of Matt Schlapp, that were basically making all of the, you know, the president's case, so to speak. You know, Laxalt is a lawyer and was literally in some cases and figuratively making the case for him. But basically, we've heard that Trump, that the RNC, that Mitch McConnell himself favor Laxalt, that many other senators favor Laxalt, and this, of course, scares away many of those moderate candidates that we've talked about. All of these candidates we talk about for governor, you know, a half dozen folks, any one of them could, in theory, slot in to a Senate race if they wanted to, but they don't want to because they know that they're running into a buzzsaw that is, you would be running against the Trump candidate, the candidate with, you know, with good name recognition in the state. I don't think there's any way around that Laxalt would be able to summon large amounts of national money. I think that is accurate. I mean, I think he's the type of person who could get a Trump email blasted out across, you know, the country to millions and millions of people and could get a lot of small dollar donations as well as, you know, corporate donations from folks who, you know, have it out against, you know, what the Senate is doing or what the, you know, the current, you know, presidential administration is doing or whatever their grievances are. And I just think that, you know, so Kiekhoffer's a good example. I mean, Kiekhoffer has been said that he gave me the same sort of explanation as John J. Lee, where he says he has been approached about the Senate. He's considering it. But it would be very, very tough for him to get out. I know an argument, as you said, could be made that he might do better in the general once he gets it, but they're never going to make it. So the idea is that unless Laxalt decides against it, which there's no strong indications that he is. He's wanted it, you know, and been rumored for it for years now, you know, basically since losing the Sisolak election. It looks like it's going to be Laxalt and Cortez Masto. And then you're talking about a national sort of race, basically, where the ideologies of the current president and the former president are totally on the ballot and will totally bash up against each other. And talking to folks around here, they think if that race is close, if they feel like Laxalt has a chance, if it's, you know, it's getting, you know, hot and heavy in the summer of 2022, that race could draw $100 million in spending. As folks say, that might not even be a low estimate because, you know, there's a lot at stake nationally. The Senate is, the Democratic majority in the Senate is so thin that you only need one. And for Republicans, you know, Catherine Cortez Masto is in the leadership and rising in Democratic power. She would be a great one to get, and they're going to do anything that they can to get her.
Yeah. I mean, that is true. All things being equal, if I was a Republican, I would rather run against Sisolak than Catherine Cortez Masto.
Because many Republicans agree with you here.
Because Catherine Cortez Masto is so disciplined and so focused and so smart that she is not a one given to making tactical mistakes. And she has had all sorts of experience, whether as a federal prosecutor, chief of staff to Governor Miller, you know, all sorts of things that have led her to this moment. That I think it will be very difficult for anyone to unseat her, and I think there's a little bit of a romance going on with between the base and Adam Laxalt, and that romance is blinding them to the fact that in the general election against Catherine Cortez Masto, it's going to be very difficult for anyone to beat her, but Laxalt, who did not run a good campaign and whose popularity, I think, persists in the Republican base, notwithstanding that fact, rather than because of it. His performance did not commend him, I think, to anybody who was, you know, really interested in winning elections. And so I think the base is sort of, you know, with their hearts is embracing Laxalt. But I think other Republicans are looking at it and saying, look, if he's our guy, that race is lost. We're not going to be able to win that race with that candidate. Now, Ben Kiekhefer in the general, that's another story. Mark Hutchison, that's another story. I mean, they would have a better chance to do it. But it is an uphill climb for anybody, I think, in this race, especially given the resources that she is going to have as a member of leadership, the support that she has. Remember, she was Harry Reid's handpicked successor for his seat. And Harry Reid does not want to see his seat fall to a Republican of any stripe, much less to fall to Adam Laxalt. So I think of the two candidates, she is better positioned going in to next year, going into these elections. And I think she's going to be a better candidate. I really do think she's going to be a better candidate in her 2016 race against Joe Heck, who by the way, was a really good candidate in his own right. I think she just performed better. She performed really well in their one debate, which I was at. I was one of the moderators in their Channel 8 debate. I remember very well those two going at it, and I think they were both very good, but she was really good. I mean, it's going to be difficult. Anyone contemplating a run against Catherine Cortez Masto is going to have to be a very disciplined campaigner, and they're really going to have to find things that work against her. And I don't know that there's a lot of stuff that can be, you know, brought to bear against her, because I think she, in terms of what a U.S. senator should do for her state, I think she's done all that. I think she's done all those things. As late as today, you know, you went to an event today where she's there touting the delivery of the vaccines, the American Rescue Plan, and as you point out, and I think the point you made earlier, this is a key point. Next year, now we're talking about everybody getting the vaccine, getting people back to work, et cetera, et cetera. In May 2022, we will be talking about recovery. We'll be talking about the conventions are coming back and the casinos are busy again. And McCarran Airport's once again reaching for a record. Maybe we'll hit 50 million.
Harry Reid Airport.
That's right, Harry Reid. That's right.
We're talking Harry Reid part 2022.
Airport by then. And all of those things are going to make it a completely different world. And she will be one of the people on the leading edge of that, saying, this is not, you know, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do or what I'd like to do. I'm going to tell you what I have done. And here's the evidence and proof of that. And oh, by the way, you're welcome for the infrastructure plan and the recovery plan and everything else that we have done for the state of Nevada. So I think, of the two, I would be more worried if I was Sisolak, less so than if I was Catherine Cortez Masto. And the Republican who gets the honor of challenging Cortez Masto is going to have to really bring the A game when they do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and we talked about this before when Vice President Kamala Harris visited as well. the Biden administration and really Democrats really across, you know, all branches of government, essentially, because we also saw Congresswoman Titus and Congresswoman Lee also in town holding events, you know, to this effect as well. And that rescue plan, you know, the latest stimulus package, enormously popular, polling at, you know, 75% type of approval from the people nationwide. And every Democrat has not only passed it, not only, you know, seen its implementation, but they're taking a lap. And that's what I saw this morning, which was essentially, you know, Cortez Masto and Rosen basically saying, you know, we're out to share to everybody, to let everybody know that, one, we did this. It was hard work. There were no Republicans who supported this bill, and we got it. We got it through. That's hard work. And Senator Rosen said that flat out to me today, that, look, this is, you know, she looked at the Cashman Center and said, this is the result of our hard work. And the second thing, to also, you know, spread awareness of, like, you know, what all is available. I mean, if you get a check deposited, you know, to you in the IRS, and, oh, wow, yeah, you're aware of that. But, you know, there are increased medical benefits, increased unemployment benefits. We, you know, we've talked about it all before, and they're definitely taking a lap. And definitely, I think there's a very conscious effort among all Democrats to peg that very popular, you know, rescue plan to the Democrats and not the Republicans, and to really, really highlight that Republicans had no say and even tried to stop this from happening, which I think is accurate. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's true. The consensus among everybody that I've talked to is that Laxalt seems to be the candidate. But is there a consensus that he's the one to beat her? That's when people get a little bit more quiet when you're talking to folks around here, Republican operatives and such. I think everybody does admit that it will be harder for him to beat Cortez Masto than it would have been to even beat Sisolak, because she is, like you said, she is very, very disciplined, very organized, has staff already doing campaign work. Some of these Republicans that we're talking about, Kiefer, Gansert, and Laxalt and stuff, are being watched by Democratic operatives at the moment. They're filling out the files that you do, the opposition research that you do is happening. And we're a year away from the filing deadline, even, let alone the election. So I yeah, you're talking about very disciplined, somebody who's the heir apparent to state Democratic Party power in Nevada. And, you know, I definitely wanted to also mention that there has been one other very prominent name that has been mentioned in the rumor mill for Senate, and that is Brian Sandoval. And I did reach out to him through the university, and I got a polite but very direct response, which was essentially that Governor Sandoval is not even going to waste the time it takes to have a conversation about his lack of interest, because he's so focused on what he's doing as president of the University of Reno. I've heard from folks that he has absolutely no interest in running against Catherine Cortez Masto. He's been quite complimentary of her in the past, as he does now work for a public university and has to work, you know, with senators and legislators as well. And he's more of a moderate. I don't think he would want a knockdown, dragout fight with Laxalt either, who was his attorney general. I don't think he would want that. I think Sandoval is clearly, he's not a Trump loving styled Republican by any stretch, even though many Republicans, you know, may perhaps under their breath, but, you know, around here would love it if he ran for Senate, because he'd have a very good chance in the general. He's still very, very popular.
Oh yeah, no, he would be the gold, the unicorn candidate, the golden candidate.
Yeah, it's this weird dichotomy between primary politics and general election politics that you see in these two races that is very, very interesting. And obviously, it is extremely early. There, you know, definitely check out the story. There's plenty of time for things to happen.
To close this out, the one thing about Sandoval was that he proved he could win in primaries and generals, and he did so with the opprobrium of the Republican base. I don't think I saw Brian Sandoval once at a Republican convention in this state the whole time he was governor. I saw lieutenant governors, I saw Congress members, I saw others. I never saw Sandoval there. He just basically ignored the party and bypassed it, and it didn't hurt him. it didn't hurt him because there were crossover Republican votes, crossover Democratic votes that helped him out. So I think he is one of those rare people who, if he decided to get into the race for Senate, would be able to win a primary and would be able to defeat Laxalt, although that would be kind of an interesting thing to watch how he would go about doing that. But as you said, I think his response is absolutely right on. He didn't have any interest in going to Washington, D.C. when he was serving as governor. He has served in all branches of Nevada government, but I don't think he has even the slightest bit of interest in leaving. He loves the job at UNR. He's wanted that job for a long time, and I don't think he is inclined to go absolutely anywhere now that he's got it. So, so I don't think we're going to be seeing Brian Sandoval's name on a ballot anytime
and
soon.
We wanted to end on a little bit of a lighter note. We had talked a couple episodes ago, a couple weeks ago, about the possibility. It had reported that there was a possibility that Dan Rodheimer, who challenged Susie Lee in the most recent election in Nevada's 3rd District as a Republican, had moved to Texas and was planning to run for Congress in Texas. There was a congressman there in Texas who passed away, and Dan Rodheimer is in a very large primary field. Then it also includes the congressman's widow, who is the favorite to win that race. And basically he put forth one of his what's becoming a signature sort of style of ad out that was pretty widely mocked and ridiculed, I would say, because I did see Republicans even like I think it was actually Congressman Matt Gaetz, who also had himself a very interesting week. I think it was him who actually mocked it quite openly. And really, like I said, both parties, I saw national news coverage eventually get to the fact that he's, you know, dressed as a cowboy, riding a bull, doing a Texas accent, months after living in Nevada, speaking in, you know, a sort of standard Western accent, and dressed in a completely different way with a completely different background. He had essentially, to use a nerddom term, he had essentially retconned his background the previous election did not in fact happen, and now he's a cowboy and speaking with an accent and everything like that, and he was heckled mercilessly. I don't think any the Texans especially did not take it. And we talked about this before. To go and essentially carpet bag a district is one thing, but Texans really don't like it because there's a lot of state pride of being a Texan. And when you're an outsider, when you went to school in New Jersey, I believe it was, and, you know, lived in Florida when you were a professional wrestler, is really from all over the place and not so much a Texan. They really don't particularly like that. I saw it universally heckled, and I know you plan to join in the chorus.
Yes, yeah, I'm planning. Sunday's newspaper will have a little item on this, and you know it's funny too, because look, all politicians have ambition. There's no question about that. If you didn't have ambition, you wouldn't run. You wouldn't say that out of the 700,000 people in this congressional district, I ought to be the one to represent all of them in D.C. That takes a certain amount of hubris. And so, you know, that's, yeah, you know, something that's common and probably is forgiven for most of these people. But to so radically change, to pretend that you're a bull riding, hat wearing Texan when you have just, you know, basically just arrived in the state. And you just beat the residency requirement. You're so new that you don't know where to even file your papers for the special election that you're going to run in. I mean, that to me, I think is that is a level of hubris even beyond that sort of thing. And one of the things that people liked about Donald Trump was authenticity. And I think Donald Trump proved, if no one else, that authenticity can be a morally neutral virtue. But you had no doubt when Donald Trump was speaking that you were listening to the real Donald Trump. I mean, this is who the guy is, and he made no pretenses about it. In fact, he made that into a little a little meme about himself was that he was plain spoken and all that kind of stuff. And when you see somebody like this do something like this, which is essentially the very opposite of authenticity, I think that does turn voters off. And, you know, it's been tried here in the state of Nevada. We've had people come from Hollywood and try to run for governor, try to buy their way in for governor. Because they thought, well, Nevada's a small state and they're kind of rubes and we'll be able to pull the wool over their eyes. It didn't work. It doesn't work. Voters know who is and who is not an authentic person, resident of that particular area. And I think they're going to find this one out pretty quickly. The ad that he did was, I think, almost comical. And the reaction to it, you know, is not the reaction that you want when you do this ad. At one point, he was trying to say how we Texans have these certain values and that people like Nancy Pelosi in Washington hate those values. And he said they are laughing at us because of that. And the fact of the matter is they indeed are laughing, but they're laughing at you and for not the reasons that you think. They're laughing at you because this ad is just so ridiculous and over the top, and it's just not going to fool anybody. It's it is sort of the political equivalent of professional wrestling. And while it may be entertaining, you know, nobody is really going to buy into it, with rare exceptions like Jesse Ventura in Minnesota, Arnold Schwarzenegger in California. And there are people who argue that Jesse Ventura was a fine governor and that Arnold Schwarzenegger was the same in California. And some of the things that he did, were very good. He was good at the job. When you see somebody like this who just so badly wants to be in Congress that they will debase themselves in this manner, I think people are more repelled than attracted by that. And I think it's probably going to come to naught. As you pointed out, it's a crowded field. There's 22 people in that special election. It is going to be decided in May. So we'll know by May, and we'll certainly bring the results of that to our faithful listeners.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just got to feel interesting for folks in the third district who voted for him. There's 191,000 people in Nevada living right. I live in the third district. My neighbors, I'm certain there are some of them who voted for him. I mean, he was I think a pretty respectable, you know, loss that he had. I mean, he lost by about 3%, and that's not, you know, like, you know, career ending, I don't think, by any sort of means. And then he goes and does this. And you mentioned the professional wrestling, and that was that. Anybody who's asked me about him, because I've been to many of his events, seen him speak many, many times. And you know, some reporters in Texas now have started to ask me, and, you know, others, you know, always ask me, like, what's his deal? It's like, it is professional wrestling. If you ever watch it, he's doing professional wrestling promos as political theater, where, you know, he did a bit about taking a steel chair to the establishment and stuff. I mean, it was that, like, brazen. It wasn't even sort of subverted in there. No, it was, he was literally beating people over the head with these metaphors and stuff. And one of the things that happens in professional wrestling is if you have a gimmick in a certain area or territory or whatever, and it's not working, you leave and you totally reinvent this new character to be somewhere else. And I think that's exactly what happened. We've never seen somebody be so, you know, thorough on the professional wrestling is exactly like politics sort of gimmick, and that's really what it is. He just got a new gimmick.
Yep, and a new venue for it, and who knows? You know, if this doesn't work out, there's plenty of other states in the union. Sure. There's plenty of other elections that every 2 years. Oh. It happens every two years. So there. So we have not heard the last of Dan Rodheimer. And on your point, as to your point, in terms of his electoral performance, he didn't embarrass himself. No. You know, when he ran for state senate in 2018, he lost to a former member of the assembly. Who was sort of neutrally regarded, but he beat a former state senator who was a sort of an inconsequential state senator, but nonetheless a name that people knew in Nevada. He beat her to come in second in that Republican primary in 2018. And then in 2020, he beat a field of candidates that included a former statewide elected official. to win the nomination. So it's not like he is completely ridiculous and, you know, loses all the time and makes a fool of himself. He actually has a record of winning certain primaries. And so, you know, he does have something to go on. Whether or not he should have maybe stayed in Nevada and run for another office and then sort of tried to build on that, I think is another thing. But I think, you know, I agree with you. I think he realized, okay, well, I've tried twice, once in a small district, once in a larger district, probably the opposite of how it should have been. People aren't buying it here. Maybe it's time to move on to somewhere else. And this special election is sort of a gimme, right? It's like the space between spaces, you know, the 2020 and then 2022. He loses this one, he can still start gearing up for 2022 and see what happens then. So maybe someday we will see Dan, Big Dan Roedheimer in the Congress of the United States. And if we do, the plaque outside his office, I really hope, has Big Dan in quotation marks, well, from whatever state he ends up representing.
Absolutely. Well, we'll always keep our eye on that and all these other elections that we talked about. It's plenty for this week, I think. You can always find us every Friday. You can find us on social media at Rory Does Phonics and at Steve Sibelius on Twitter. And make sure that you're liking and subscribing wherever you get your podcast, wherever you're listening right this second, make sure that you do it. As always, I am politics reporter Rory Appleton.
And I'm politics and government editor Steve Sibelius.
Thanks so much for listening.